submitted a standardized test score and those who did not. And graduation rates for submitters were only 0.6% higher than those of non-submitters. In other words, trivial differences. When I shared my personal experience with Hiss, he told me by email that the disconnect between my SAT scores and later academic and career success is quote-unquote strikingly common. In our one study, there were tens of thousands of students whom any statistician would call false negatives. That is, these students' SAT scores suggest they could not do strong work in college when in fact they can. Simply put, our country cannot afford to throw away up to 30% of its talent, he said. My wife and I have four children. Three have completed the SATs and college application process, and each has done very well, so my disenchantment with this standardized test is not born of sour grapes, at least not on their behalf. In fact, one of our kids achieved a superscored perfect SAT, 2,400 points, clearly his mother's child. But not even that accomplishment has changed my view as to the limitations of the SAT in judging one's college aptitude and future success. One of ours still needs to navigate this world, and I really feel for him. If he were able to redirect the time he will now spend on test prep toward instead learning a musical instrument, he'd be proficient by the time he will sit for that exam. Worthy subject of protest may target workers. Philadelphia Inquirer, May 18, 2014. 2 weeks ago, I spent the weekend in Los Angeles. I was there to give a speech, attend a book signing, and deliver a radio show. The speech was at a Monday luncheon, and upon arrival back at my hotel, I could see there was a commotion across the street, but I wasn't initially sure of the cause. Inside my room, I had a surreal experience watching the local news. There was the exterior of the hotel, complete with a shot that depicted my open door leading to a small balcony. It was then that I learned that Jay Leno was among a few dozen protesters complaining about the hotel's ownership. The Landmark, where I was staying, best known for five-star service and an iconic roofline that adorned the album cover of the Eagles' Hotel California, was the Beverly Hills Hotel. Leno and company were calling attention to the fact that far up the hotel ownership chain sits the Sultan of Brunei, who was in the process of instituting Sharia law in his tiny, oil-rich nation. I had no idea of the ownership connection prior to my stay. The hotel website and my electronic key touted the Dorchester collection of hotels and referenced several other well-known properties. I departed the night of the protest to catch a scheduled red-eye to Philadelphia, so I never had to confront the issue of whether I'd continue to stay at the hotel given my newfound knowledge. The night after my departure, the Beverly Hills City Council passed a resolution, 5-0, that, quote, urges the government of Brunei to divest itself of the Beverly Hills Hotel and any other properties it may own in Beverly Hills, unquote. The hotel pays $7 million in annual bed taxes and an additional $4 million in city taxes. Soon thereafter, at a town hall meeting for employees, the hotel management announced that all jobs and wages of employees are secure despite the decline in business. I was happy to hear that. I have no sympathy for the Sultan. The idea of Sharia is abhorrent. But I do for those workers. News accounts say that 600 people work at the hotel, and over the span of two nights, I had interactions with many of them. Like the guy who needed to take an iron to my suit because it looked like a truck ran over it when I unpacked. Or the valet who helped retrieve my rental car. The housekeeping supervisor who saw a half dozen of my books in my room and felt obliged to put a bookmark in each. And the concierge who gave me driving directions. They aren't members of Hollywood's rich and famous. I doubt any of them live in Beverly Hills. They're American workers hustling to earn a living who are now probably a bit fearful about their jobs in a tough economy. Despite management's assurance, one has to wonder whether a protracted protest will ultimately jeopardize their livelihoods. The only certainty seems that the protest will have no impact on the intended target. No protest of the Beverly Hills Hotel can impact the Sultan's wealth. His country is only the size of Delaware, yet it's the fifth richest in the world, so wealthy that all of its citizens receive free education and health care. A friend had joined me at the hotel. Only now am I remembering that after he booked his room online, he kept tabs on the rate being charged and alerted me to two reductions, enabling both of us to negotiate a savings. Perhaps that was attributable to cancellations spurred by the high-profile protest movement. Ellen DeGeneres is on board, and so too is Sir Richard Branson. Project CARE, the Motion Picture and Television Fund, and the Beverly Hills Bar Association have all canceled events. Stephen Young, who was on the board of the association's charitable arm, told me that he was, quote, shocked to learn of the hotel's ownership. He said that where his group, quote, stands for the highest principles of justice, the violations of human rights through the implementation of harsh criminal laws, including the chopping off of limbs, the stoning of homosexuals and adulterers, and the unconscionable treatment of women, all of which are an anathema to our American values, made it morally untenable to continue to patronize the hotel. In making the decision not to further patronize the hotel, there was a full recognition that innocent management and staff members of the hotel may be adversely affected, he said. Perhaps a better way to protect those innocents would be a response from the White House. Last March, President Obama met with the Sultan in the Oval Office, where he opened a media availability by remarking, quote, well, it is a great pleasure to welcome my good friend, His Majesty the Sultan of Brunei. He is a key leader in the Southeast Asia region, but also widely respected around the world, unquote. I can find no statement of condemnation by the White House or State Department on the implementation of Sharia law in Brunei. Perhaps the Hollywood elite would be better served enlisting the support of a president whose ear they certainly have, rather than putting American workers in the crosshairs. Not long after I wrote this column and repeated my sentiments in a commentary on CNN, I was invited to return to Los Angeles to appear on Real Time with Bill Maher. For a show like Maher's, airfare and accommodations are usually comped. When I told the show's booker that I wanted to stay at the Beverly Hills Hotel, she replied, well, do you know that there's a protest underway? Yeah, I said. That's why I want to stay there. To Real Time's credit, they satisfied my request. Upon arrival at the Beverly Hills Hotel, I couldn't help but notice how empty the place felt. While checking in, I was greeted at the front desk by Director of Guest Relations, Stephen Boggs. Stephen escorted me to my fabulous room and said the general manager hoped I'd join him for coffee the following day in the Polo Lounge. After I agreed, Stephen confirmed the 11 a.m. appointment with a handwritten note, classic Beverly Hills Hotel. So the following morning, I sat with Edward Mady, the regional director of West Coast USA for the Dorchester Collection, in the outdoor patio section of the legendary Polo Lounge. He was the top management official for both the Beverly Hills Hotel and Hotel Bel Air, and a terrific guy. To meet him is to immediately appreciate his orientation toward detail. Nothing escapes his attention. Mady said he was grateful for my support and explained to me some of the backstory of the dispute, namely how at its core this was not a dispute about Sharia law, but labor. Neither the Beverly Hills Hotel nor Hotel Bel Air were union hotels, and advocates for their unionization had seized the Sharia issue to bring pressure to bear, a point lost on the Hollywood protesters. Anyway, after about a half an hour of tea and pleasantries, Mady excused himself from the table, and I didn't think much of his brief absence. When he returned, he asked me to join him. So I stood and followed as Mady exited a gate I hadn't even noticed. Within seconds, in a small grassy area adjacent to the hotel's famed bungalows, I found myself surrounded by every employee of the Beverly Hills Hotel then on duty, and they were applauding me for my support. It was a totally unexpected and overwhelming experience. Then Mady presented me with a framed photograph of the exterior of the Pink Hotel with the employees standing in front, and on the matting, each had signed their name and many had added a personal message. Quote, we are, all caps, the Beverly Hills Hotel. Thank you for telling our story, unquote, read one of them. Mady kindly shipped the framed photograph to my home and enclosed a personal note saying, you have 647 fans at this hotel and 351 at the Hotel Bel Air. 5 stars indeed. I have since returned to the hotel on several occasions and can report that to my untrained eye, it appears that business has been completely restored. Mystery tip that broke Sandusky case. Philadelphia Inquirer, June 29, 2014. Nearly 2 years after a 15-year-old boy first reported being abused by Jerry Sandusky, the Attorney General's investigation was moribund. Very little progress had been made since the office took over the probe. The victim's mother was understandably frustrated, and the prosecutor assigned to the case considered it, quote-unquote, stalled. It could have easily ended there, and Sandusky might be a free man today if not for a concerned citizen whose name does not appear on any of the 339 pages of independent investigator H. Jeffrey Moulton Jr.'s recently released report to the Attorney General. The report of victim number one, a ninth grader known only as AF, was made by his mother to school administrators in November 2008. County officials eventually referred it to the Attorney General's office in March 2009. At the time, the report notes, the office was, quote, heavily invested in Bonusgate, unquote, a political corruption prosecution. Also that month, then-Attorney General Tom Corbett announced that he was exploring a run for governor. Given that prosecutors deemed the first victim credible, Sandusky could have been arrested immediately. Instead, they decided to use the secret grand jury process to search for more victims and bolster the case. In June 2009, AF appeared before the grand jury and testified that he had engaged in oral sex with Sandusky. He returned to the grand jury in November 2009, a year after his initial report, because prosecutors wanted to gauge his ability to describe the crime on his own rather than in response to a prosecutor's leading questions. He was able to do so. As 2009 ended, Senior Deputy Attorney General Janelle Eschbach believed she had sufficient evidence to have Sandusky arrested, but her supervisors disagreed. At least one grand juror wanted to know when there would be progress, according to Moulton's report, asking Eschbach, quote, when do you see this moving forward, unquote. In March 2010, 16 months after the first report of abuse, Eschbach delivered a draft presentment recommending charges against Sandusky to Glenn Parno, who had temporarily assumed the responsibilities of Chief Deputy Attorney General Frank Fina, who was involved in an extended trial. Months passed without a reply or significant progress in the case. In May 2010, the report says Eschbach wrote to an investigator, quote, despite asking, begging, pleading, I have heard nothing, unquote. Still, more time elapsed. In July 2010, Eschbach wrote to several colleagues, quote, the grand jury asked me again, as they have for the last 4 months, why we don't have the particular presentment for them. They are very anxious to approve it. Likewise, I continue to get calls and mail from the victim's mother and therapist. Can someone please tell me what the holdup is, unquote. It had been 20 months since the first report that a 15-year-old boy had been abused by Jerry Sandusky. The following month, AF's mother wrote in an email to Eschbach, quote, it's been a long time on this case, and another school year is coming up. Why has this not been dealt with already? This is causing my family a lot of stress and anxiety. Please let me know what's going on, unquote. Eschbach forwarded that email to colleagues with another request, quote, does anyone want to answer my questions about why we are stalled since winter, unquote. Fina replied, quote, we are still working on the case, looking for better corroboration of our single victim. We need to do everything possible to find other victims, unquote. And so, on the verge of the fall of 2010, which would mark 2 years since AF's credible report of abuse, Sandusky was a free man and the investigation was at a standstill. Then came the lucky break that may have saved the case. On November 3, 2010, the day after Corbett was elected governor, Centre County District Attorney Stacy Parks Miller received an email. Ms. Miller, it said, quote, I am contacting you regarding the Jerry Sandusky investigation. If you have not yet done so, you need to contact and interview Penn State football assistant coach Mike McQueary. He may have witnessed something involving Jerry Sandusky and a child that would be pertinent to the investigation, unquote. It was signed only a quote-unquote concerned citizen. The only information about this citizen supplied in the report comes in a footnote on page 62, quote, according to the author of the email, he had recently heard rumors that Sandusky was being investigated for child abuse and assumed that any such investigation would involve the Centre County District Attorney's Office. In addition, he had recently heard from a member of Michael McQueary's family that McQueary had firsthand information about Sandusky that would be relevant to such an investigation, unquote. The tip broke the case wide open. A week later, investigators knocked on McQueary's door, and he agreed to cooperate. New resources were committed to the case, subpoenas were issued, evidence was assembled, and Sandusky was finally charged on November 4, 2011, 32 months after the investigation had been referred to the Attorney General's office. Who was the mystery man who seems to have rescued the prosecution? A March ESPN magazine story identified him as Christopher Hauser. The magazine reported that during a chat on a Penn State football website, McQueary's older brother had told Hauser that Sandusky, who had recently retired from his charity, would probably never coach again. And he revealed that his younger brother had caught Sandusky with a boy in a locker room shower. Unlike so many who had reason to suspect Sandusky but didn't act, Hauser did, and thereby resurrected the prosecution of a serial pedophile. And that deserves more than an anonymous footnote. Too many adults in leadership roles dropped the ball in the Sandusky case when they should have been working to protect the young victims. At the time this column ran, three top Penn State officials, President Graham Spanier, Vice President Gary Schultz, and Athletic Director Tim Curley, had already lost their jobs and had been charged with various counts related to their alleged failure to report to police incriminating evidence about Sandusky that would have ended Sandusky's crime spree much sooner. After 5 years of maintaining their innocence, Schultz and Curley pled guilty to misdemeanor child endangerment and agreed to cooperate in the case against Spanier. In 2017, Spanier was convicted by a jury of misdemeanor child endangerment. Head football coach Joe Paterno had been fired shortly after the scandal went public in late 2011 and died in January of 2012. He passed several months before seeing his statue removed from Penn State's campus and before seeing the NCAA vacate all of his program's wins from 1998 through 2011, a decision that would be reversed in 2015 after Penn State successfully sued the NCAA for due process violations. His statue remains in storage as of this writing. For his troubles, Mike McQueary was fired from his coaching position in 2011, but in October of 2016, he won a lawsuit against Penn State for wrongful termination and other charges, resulting in a total payout of over $7 million. Penn State's appeal is still pending at press time. And in August of 2016, a Pennsylvania jury convicted Attorney General Kathleen Kane of 9 criminal charges, including perjury, finding that she had leaked grand jury information as a means of political retribution against Sandusky prosecutor Frank Fina, and then lied about it. She resigned. By then, she'd already lost her law license and was subsequently sentenced to 10 to 23 months in prison. I have no update to report on private citizen and Penn State fan Christopher Hauser, the unsung hero of the Sandusky prosecution. But for him, Jerry Sandusky could still be preying on kids. Recalling Gary Hart, debating news policy. Philadelphia Inquirer, October 12, 2014. Gary Hart's downfall in the run-up to the 1988 presidential election marked an important milestone on a journalistic arc that began with Watergate, where previously the media fast track was greased by befriending politicians, now it was enhanced by bringing them down. Ever since, nothing has been out of bounds for media outlets large and small. Consider Kansas. Paul Davis, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, has been locked in a tight race against Republican incumbent Sam Brownback. 3 weeks ago, a twice-weekly local newspaper with no website called the Coffeeville Journal revealed that in 1998, Davis, then 26 and unmarried, was in a strip club getting a lap dance when the place was raided as part of a drug sting. Davis wasn't charged with a crime, but that won't stop the story's circulation through Election Day. Matt Bai's new book, All the Truth is Out, The Week Politics Went Tabloid, asks whether the all is fair game standard has been in the nation's best interest. The focus is the Hart saga, about which Bai corrects what he regards as numerous myths. Quote, even when insiders and historians recall the Hart episode now, Bai writes, they recall it in the same way. Hart issued his infamous challenge to reporters, telling them to follow him around if they didn't believe him, and then the Miami Herald took him up on it. Inexplicably, people believe Hart set his own trap and then allowed himself to become ensnared in it, unquote. Bai says that's not how it happened. The Herald was already staking out Hart by the time his so-called challenge was published by journalist E.J. Dion. And Bai says that's not just a timeline clarification. The idea that Hart set the episode in motion made it seem as if he, not the press, had changed the boundaries. Plus, you remember the photograph of Donna Rice sitting on Hart's lap? Chances are you think the photo was the smoking gun that killed his political career. Actually, the picture didn't come to light until nearly 3 weeks after he suspended his candidacy. 4 years ago, I interviewed Hart about a book he was then releasing. I asked him where reporters and observers should draw the line today on covering politicians' personal lives. He said, quote, the standard that got changed, I think 20 or 25 years ago, was that a public person's private life was of importance only if it affected their ability to do their job. I think that was a pretty good standard, and it permitted some people who are flawed human beings, as we all are, to continue to serve their country, unquote. Maybe he's right. After all, as Hart noted, if today's standard had been applied in decades past, the country would have been denied the service of Franklin Roosevelt, Dwight Eisenhower, and John Kennedy, among others. Bill Clinton was missing from his list, but deserves mention too. Some might argue that by Hart's own standard, he was rendered unqualified to serve, that a president carrying on an extramarital affair could be compromised by enemies foreign and domestic. But that's only because we ostracize behavior, which is, arguably, none of our business. Tom Fiedler disagrees. Today, he is the dean of the College of Communication at Boston University, but 30 years ago, he was a political reporter for the Miami Herald whose phone rang with the tip that would eventually sink Hart. Recently on CNN, he told me that Hart's challenge had been issued before Dion wrote about it and that, quote, Senator Hart himself raised that issue as really a measure of who he was, of his own authenticity, unquote. I asked Fiedler about the propriety of three Herald reporters and a photographer literally cornering Hart in an alley adjacent to his home. He said they were there to confirm a tip that Hart was spending the weekend with Rice. Quote, you somehow make it sound like what we were doing was somehow out of the bounds of journalism, Fiedler said. It was very much in bounds of what journalists do, unquote. When I noted that the tip was about infidelity, he disagreed. Quote, the tip was about lying, he responded. He had lied to everyone, the public included, that he claimed he was not engaged in this kind of behavior. That was the tip, that he was indeed engaged in this behavior, and we checked out the tip. We felt that it's important that voters be able to consider, when they're looking at a person's fitness for office, they should be able to take into account what his character included, and it included lying about, as it happened, infidelity, unquote. When I shared that recollection with Bai, he was quick to respond. Quote, when they were in that alley on May 2, 1987, and four reporters and a photographer had the presumed Democratic nominee, the guy who was beating George H.W. Bush in the polls by double digits, and they have him backed up against a brick wall in a white hoodie, and they are peppering him with questions about the woman who they saw entering and leaving his home? The question was not, you said you were not cheating on your wife, so how do you explain the lie? What Tom Fiedler said to him is, you held yourself out when you announced, as a politician who would hold himself to a high moral standard, who is that woman in your house? Unquote. Bai sees significance in the fact that Hart's announcement comments about the need for morality were in the context of addressing official misbehavior, Iran-Contra, and a series of Reagan administration scandals. Quote, he was not talking about his marital vows, Bai told me, noting that the Herald reporters made no such distinction. Perhaps it was never for us to condemn Hart. That job was for Lee, his wife. And how ironic that after more than 50 years, they're still together. In December of 2016, I was offered an interview with Donna Rice, now Donna Rice Hughes, since her marriage to Jack Hughes in 1994, for my SiriusXM POTUS program. She's become a leading internet safety proponent and is the president and CEO of Enough is Enough, a nonprofit that lobbies for that cause. I was willing to afford her the opportunity to make her points about her cause, but was eager to ask if these many years later, she thought Gary Hart had been treated unfairly by the outing of their relationship. Quote, here's the thing. There had been an understanding, if you will, between people in politics, primarily men, and the media, she said. And that changed in 1987. I think to some degree, there was a perfect storm that was set up here. I don't know if the media was necessarily out to get him, but there had been hints that people were trying to get to who he was because he was a bit aloof, from what I understand, with the media, unquote. I explained to her that what especially concerns me is that people avoid running for office because they know it will mean airing all their dirty laundry. And I asked, how small of a pool does that really leave? She replied, quote, we're all human and we can understand that people are not perfect and they're going to have things in their life that they are not proud of, unquote. I asked if she had ever again spoken to Hart. She said, quote, he called me many years later during one of President Clinton's many scandals and he called and asked for my forgiveness. And I really appreciated that and told him that a long time ago I had forgiven him and anyone else that was involved with that, unquote. Overreaction in the C.B. West hazing case. Philadelphia Inquirer, November 2nd, 2014. Had you Googled Central Bucks West before the October 23rd suspension of its football season, I suspect you'd have found links to such noted alumni as NFL referee Scott Green, who officiated three Super Bowls, Kevin Ward, who played for the San Diego Padres, and maybe the recording artist known as Pink, who attended but did not graduate. From its inception in 1952 until the construction of crosstown rival CB East in 1969, the school on West Court Street in Doylestown was known as Central Bucks High School. Graduates from that era included race car driver Al Holbert, an inductee of International Motorsports Hall of Fame, and Fred Fielding, White House counsel to Presidents Ronald Reagan and George W. Bush. Ask the locals about C.B. West's origins, and they'll likely direct you to the placard and stone facade that stand in honor of the old Doylestown High School, counting among its progeny author James Michener and anthropologist Margaret Mead. Of course, scholarship matters, but what has garnered the most attention for the school in the modern era is its extraordinary football program under the direction of Coach Mike Pettine Sr., who amassed a record of 326 wins, 42 losses, and 4 ties, and 4 state titles while at the Bucks helm. Today, his son and namesake, a graduate of CB West and the University of Virginia, is head coach of the Cleveland Browns. It's sad that the school's reputation, earned over generations, is now in jeopardy, both from the bad behavior of student athletes and the overzealous reaction of adults. In times like these, many of us have a tendency to reflect on the indiscretions of our own youth, but they can be compared only in context. The foolish things that I did in my 3 years at CB West are evidenced only by the strength of memory. In the digital age, nothing is ever erased. Now, regardless of the outcome, the actions of the school board in an internet age will always follow CB West. In his written notification to the community, Central Bucks School District Superintendent David P. Wetzel said, quote, "Our inquiry determined that students new to the team were expected to participate in several initiations that were both humiliating and inappropriate. The most personally invasive activity required a rookie to grab another player's private parts while fully clothed. These initiations took place in front of most team members," unquote. The lack of specificity in the statement furthered the harm done to perpetrators and victims because it allowed minds to wander and rumors to spawn. Suddenly, CB West had been mentioned in the same breath as Sayreville High School in New Jersey, where sexual assault charges have been filed against 7 members of the football team. At CB West, no student has served a detention, much less been suspended for the behavior alleged. A better course would have been a more complete disclosure of what was known, and if administrators believe there was not enough known to fully advise the community, then by definition, no punishment was ripe to be administered. People close to the events have told me that on August 16, at the end of a week of two-a-day practices, the players had a scrimmage at home against Abington. The scrimmage ended at about 11:15 a.m. and was followed by a football parents' club picnic at noon. Last year, the picnic was held away from school, but this year, to save money, it was held on a playground adjacent to the campus. Most of the coaches, including head coach Brian Hensel, were not in attendance. During the picnic, the players left the adults and walked a short distance to the team locker room. There, the hijinks commenced. Veterans gave haircuts to rookies. Some initiates were sugar cookied, doused with talcum powder after walking through the shower. Worse, some mimicked the game Slap Lick Fondle from the Comedy Central series Tosh.0. 3 individuals face one person who has to choose one of those 3 options. When the players returned to the picnic, there was no sign of distress. Many who'd had their hair cut took selfies with family and fellow players. Exactly 2 months later, an investigation commenced into allegations that a player was punched for refusing to have his hair cut, an allegation determined to be unfounded. Thus began an investigation that uncovered the other conduct described. Then, with 2 games left to go in the season, and on the eve of the homecoming game against CB East, the district superintendent announced the suspension of the season. Justice Potter Stewart may have also been defining hazing when he said of pornography, "I know it when I see it." For me, forced haircuts and sugar cookies don't cross that line, but slap lick fondle clearly does. The perpetrators of that behavior should have been singled out and punished, and if their number was such that CB West could not field a team, then forfeiture was appropriate. Instead, the bad behavior in August has now been compounded by a school board which, in its haste, issued what amounted to a capital sentence in an internet world. Brian Hensel was fired as head coach about 2 weeks after this column was published, but still teaches science at CB West. The superintendent cited a quote-unquote lack of coach supervision when terminating Hensel, who is now an assistant football coach at Hatboro-Horsham High School. CB West's athletic director, Sean Kelly, ended up resigning in June of 2015. Cat Stevens Politics. Philadelphia Inquirer, December 14, 2014. When I bumped into DJ Pierre Robert at the Tower Theater, he had more on his mind than music. It's something of a running joke. When I see him, he seeks to engage me in political discussion while I try to steer conversation toward classic rock. On the night that Yusuf Islam, the artist formerly known as Cat Stevens, kicked off his first American tour in 38 years, those worlds collided. There were many of us at the show who were excited to hear the music, but wondering aloud about the performer's politics. I've often said that if I screen my entertainment choices according to political bent, I'd be erasing my iTunes account and surrendering my cable subscriptions. These days, I'd have to add professional athletes. So there I was, with my wife, circumnavigating the long lines outside in Upper Darby and working my way through the metal detectors, something I'd never seen in the 3 decades of attending Tower shows. A Live Nation executive told me their presence was the mutual desire of both promoter and performer. My trial lawyer buddy, Paul Loricella, offered the politically incorrect quip that it was the first time he experienced TSA-like screening to protect a Muslim from Americans. When I said hello to State Senator Dalen Leach, the Democrat from Montgomery County, just before the lights dimmed, he reminded me that Yusuf had played at Stephen Colbert and Jon Stewart's Rally to Restore Sanity, for which Stewart had been called out by Bill O'Reilly. Media and issues advocate Larry Seisler, who was seated a row behind us with his wife, quickly weighed in, telling me that as a strong supporter of Israel, he was willing to overlook, for a night, any indiscretions toward the Jewish state in the name of music. Clearly, there were many of us thinking about more than just the set list. The Wind, Where Did the Children Play, Oh Very Young, Moonshadow, Wild World, Another Saturday Night, Morning Has Broken, Peace Train, Father and Son, Sad Lisa, Miles from Nowhere. The repertoire was rich, and the recent Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee exhibited a rare voice. By the next day, not only were the songs ringing in my ears, but so too the questions raised by friends about Yusuf's worldview. My cursory internet search revealed that before Philadelphia, Yusuf played in Toronto, an event he marked with a contribution to the Toronto Star. Quote, at one time I wrote, I'm being followed by a moonshadow, moonshadow, moonshadow. Today I would amend that to, I'm being followed by a trail of misconceptions, 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 unquote, he wrote. He referenced, quote, dragon-sized myths, unquote, and directed fans to the lyrics of new songs, including Editing Floor Blues. One day the papers rang us up to check if I said this. I said, oh boy, I'd never say that. Then we got down to the truth of it, but they never printed that. On his website, YusufIslam.com, he has a section titled, quote, Chinese Whiskers, unquote, quote, dedicated to dispelling myths and rumors created around my bruising skirmishes with the media, unquote. Perusing the site, it became obvious that these days, Yusuf is catching it from all sides. One of the frequently asked questions is why he has stopped wearing Muslim robes. In further addressing his faith, Yusuf comments that he feels, quote, very fortunate that I got to know Islam before it became a major headline, unquote. And he offers an opinion as to why he was stopped from entry to the United States post 9/11. Quote, no reason was ever given, but being asked to repeat the spelling of my name again and again made me think it was a fairly simple mistake of identity. Rumors which circulated after made me imagine otherwise. I'm now free to travel to the U.S., so whatever it was has been resolved, unquote. But it was whether he'd once supported a fatwa against author Salman Rushdie that I'd heard most raised the night before, and I was pleased to see Yusuf offer context. Quote, because of imaginary scenarios set by courthouse TV interviewers, in 1989 I was drawn into making stupid and offensive jokes about Rushdie on a program called Hypotheticals. However, they were meant to lighten the moment and raise a smile, as a good old British sense of humor occasionally is known to do. Unfortunately for me, it didn't. In 1989, during the heat and height of the Satanic Versus controversy, I was silly enough to accept appearing on Hypotheticals, which posed imaginary scenarios by a well-versed what-if barrister, Jeffrey Robertson. I foolishly made light of certain provocative questions. When asked what I'd do if Salman Rushdie entered a restaurant in which I was eating, I said I would probably call up Ayatollah Khomeini, and rather than go to a demonstration to burn an effigy of the author, I jokingly said I would have preferred that it would be the real thing. Criticize me for bad taste. In hindsight, I agree. but these comments were part of a well-known British national trait, a touch of dry humor on my part, unquote. Yusuf claims to never have, quote-unquote, knowingly supported Hamas, and most important to me, he denounced terrorism. Quote, like all right-minded people, I absolutely condemn all acts of terrorism, including the attacks of 9/11 and 7/7, the July 7, 2005 bombings in London that killed nearly 60 people. The actions of the terrorists were completely un-Islamic and against the teachings and example of the Prophet. It's everybody's responsibility to make this world a safer, more peaceful place, unquote. It was all the information I wished I'd have known the night before so that I would have celebrated the man as much as the music. Another mea culpa coming. First, something not in the column. For this concert, I paid more money for a pair of Cat Stevens Yusuf Islam tickets than for any other concert I've attended in my four decades of seeing shows. More than I spent for the front row of Roger Waters at Madison Square Garden. More than I paid to see the Grateful Dead's second-to-last show at Soldier Field. That will also be sad news for the artist who went to great lengths to try and mitigate ticket scalping of his shows. In fact, this show that I saw at the Tower Theater was supposed to occur at New York City's Beacon Theater, but Yusuf relocated it out of concern over inflated prices due to scalping in Manhattan. For me, this was bucket list stuff. Forever, I had hoped he would reemerge after 40 years of not touring, and there was no way I intended to miss it. My wife was with me, and we were in about the fifth row, dead center. Perfect. Coincidentally, our friends Larry and Lina were in the row behind us, two seats over. Knowing Larry, he got the seats for free. No way he paid what I paid. Directly behind us sat a young couple, the female half of which did not stop screaming and singing loudly for the entire first half of the show. Not intermittently, constantly. I did my best to stay under control, but I was doing a slow burn, and by the intermission, I was ready to blow. I paid to hear him sing, not you, I finally said. Lina interceded and used her psychological training to befriend and ultimately quiet the woman, and the second half of the show then proceeded. Larry later told me they were a Hollywood couple that had flown in just to see the show. I truly do get flying across country to see Cat Stevens, but I don't get making the trip so that you can shout over him and ruin the experience for everybody else. The column makes reference to Cat Yusuf having been stopped while seeking entry to the United States post 9/11. Left unsaid was that I defended that decision at the time. When I wrote this, I didn't recall having previously written about Cat Stevens a decade prior in a September 2004 article with the headline, "The Cat May Be Out of the Bag," or I would have said so. That column regarded the diversion of a flight carrying Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam, and in it I wrote, quote, "Islam's flight was diverted when it was determined that he was on a no-fly list, presumably due to his alleged financial connection to Hamas and support of Omar Abdel Rahman, convicted in the first World Trade Center bombing. The ex-conductor of the peace train also supported the death fatwa of Salman Rushdie," unquote. I added that I hoped the handling of this flight represented a change in airline safety protocol under Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta, which at the time included levying fines against airlines that engaged in actions similar to those taken toward Yusuf Islam. I was referring to specific instances in which American, United, Continental, and Delta Airlines were forced to pay millions of dollars for using their lawful discretion to boot passengers who the pilot believed were, quote, inimical to safety, unquote. That was a subject I dealt with extensively in my book, Flying Blind. While I could not have known in 2004 that the Department of Homeland Security was operating on bad information regarding Cat Stevens' use of Islam, I nevertheless regret my role in being a repeater of incorrect data. I have a vague recollection of having made similar comments on radio at the time, but no tapes I can listen to for recollecting. A series of successful Google searches, however, reminded me of what I said on television. On September 22, 2004, I appeared on CNN's Anderson Cooper 360. After the lead-in music, Cat Stevens, of course, faded out, Cooper tossed to a Justice Department correspondent, Kelly Arena, who provided background and then said, quote, "His supporters say he's known for advocating peace, but U.S. officials say recent information suggests Yusuf Islam has knowingly financed terrorists through Muslim charities and has knowingly associated with potential terrorists, but officials would provide no specifics," unquote. And then I was introduced and said, quote, "I think it was the right call. I mean, imagine if you were on that plane and all of a sudden they have knowledge of the fact that somebody who is Muslim and on a terrorism watch list is on board as well. Do you want that plane to enter the airspace over New York City and Washington, D.C., where it was headed? The answer to that is no," unquote. Anderson Cooper then described my book as, quote unquote, "pretty controversial," and said that what I was calling terrorist profiling would sound to some as racial profiling. Here from the transcript is my final word. Smirkanish. "Anderson, you know, profiling is not a dirty word to me. The bottom line is that on September 11, 19 individuals who had a lot of common denominators, race, religion, gender, ethnicity, and yes, appearance, they are the ones who perpetrated that attack. And my view is that we ought to be taking those characteristics into account. I mean, look at the mugshots." I don't regret my 2004 words to Anderson Cooper, especially when viewed in the context of their being said 3 years after September 11. Still, I'm sorry for Cat Stevens, Yusuf Islam, having been the subject of government misinformation, which I played a role in spreading. I'm convinced he's a man of peace, and that I jumped the gun in 2004 in defending the decision to deny him entry to the United States. While I regret the opinion I expressed years ago, I am pleased I was able to correct the record by writing the column above. I still love his music, and when Yusuf returned to the States in 2016 with his Cat's Attic tour, his second date of just 12 was in Philadelphia, and I was again there when the legendary 68-year-old songwriter walked on stage solo at the Kimmel Center and opened with Where Do the Children Play? I took my friend Mike Baldini as my date. Thankfully, we were not seated near anyone who wanted to compete with the headliner. Go old school on drinking? Philadelphia Inquirer, February 15, 2015. I pulled from a scrapbook a Weekender column I wrote for the Lehigh University Brown and White in 1982. Quote, "Friday happy hours are at Lambda Chi Alpha, Pi Lambda Phi, and Zeta Psi. Later, there's Delta Chi, Fiji, and ALO TLC, all at 10. Saturday offers Alpha Sig and Psi U at 9:30. Lambda Chi Valentine Grain Dance at 9:59, Delta Phi Crow at 10, ATO at 11. Pressure from the feds that made 21 the drinking age nationwide and liability concerns have limited that kind of lineup, and schools are still struggling to strike a proper balance. Dartmouth College just announced a prohibition of hard alcohol on campus following the lead of Stanford, Colgate, and Swarthmore. But maybe the solution lies in the past. Like Dartmouth, Lehigh has a rich Greek tradition. When I attended in the early 80s, Lehigh had as many fraternities, 36, for an undergraduate population of 4,000, as Penn State had for a community of 20,000. For Lehigh freshman men, the question used to be which house you'd be pledging, not whether. There were fraternities to suit every interest and personality. A football house, Delta Upsilon, a basketball house, Theta Delt, a lax house, Theta Chi, a wasp house, Kappa Sigma, a Jewish house, Sigma Alpha Mu, a white privilege house, Chi Psi, and even a nerd house, Psi Upsilon, although it did own its own fire truck. My fraternity, Zeta Psi, was more of a blend. We were on tap 24/7. Thursday was pub night. On Fridays, the intrafraternity council would sponsor cocktails for students and faculty at one or more houses. About once a month, we'd have a Saturday party, often themed. Except for the rare event that featured grain alcohol, I remember very little hard liquor. And given the constancy of the social life, there was no such thing as pre-gaming. Guys didn't drink in their rooms. We drank among one another. in our own bar while playing beer pong, or in the lounge watching TV. Nobody drove. Everything was contained on campus. Students with whom I have spoken tell me that the social life is still strong at Lehigh, but no longer revolves around on-campus fraternities, the number of which has decreased by one-third since I was there. One freshman told me that social life is now 90% off-campus, and while the fraternities do have parties, they need to be registered with the university so that wristbands can be distributed to the attendees who are 21 to ensure that only they drink the beer. A recent graduate, John Archibald, questioned the efficacy of the registration system and confirmed the migration off campus. Quote, with the registered fraternity parties, kids start to consume more alcohol quicker, trying to get drunk before the party starts at 10:30, so they consume a lot in a shorter time, and it's more dangerous than it needs to be, he said. Archibald graduated in 2013, then received a master's degree in 2014. His father was a fraternity brother of mine. He told me that in his senior year, 25 of the 27 members of his fraternity pledge class lived in five different off-campus houses within a block of one another. He said the social restrictions drove them off-campus, denying the young men the camaraderie that used to come from living in a fraternity in senior year. Such is the demand for off-campus housing that Archibald and his roommates placed a security deposit for their senior year at the end of the first semester of their sophomore year. Quote, it would be safer if they allowed more drinking on campus because it's going to happen anyway. And now they go to off-campus houses in an area for which students constantly get emails from campus police raising security concerns, he told me. I don't envy Sharon Basso's job. As Lehigh's dean of students, it falls to her to fashion an environment that is both socially fulfilling and safe. Where only 20% of undergraduates are 21, she said the resulting gap sets up a cat-and-mouse game on campuses for which no one has yet found a highly effective solution. Quote, we take a harm reduction approach that focuses on teaching students about healthy norms, dialogue about responsible consumption of alcohol, she said, and teach bystander intervention skills to step in and intervene when they see peers consuming alcohol dangerously, as opposed to crackdown, zero tolerance approach, unquote. By email, I could not persuade her with my old school solution. Quote, I think the issue is much more complicated than this, she wrote, citing research concluding that more than half of students who experience hazing are forced to participate in drinking games. Almost half of students had a high-risk drinking event in the last 2 weeks, and 43% of the sexual victimization incidents involved alcohol consumption by victims, and 69% involved alcohol consumption by the perpetrator. She also said the way in which students were partying has changed. Quote, on many campuses in 2015, students described their parties as gatherings that last only 2 hours, she said, and the entire focus is on getting intoxicated as efficiently as possible. That is why hard alcohol comes into the picture, unquote. At Dartmouth, Nick Desotnick has concerns about whether the crackdown on hard liquor is the solution. Desotnick is a senior, majoring in history and Asian studies. I caught up with him recently just after he'd finished his midterm in Making of the Modern World Economy. He's also a member of the Sigma Alpha Epsilon and the editor of the Dartmouth Review, the conservative newspaper on campus. Quote, I know from experience that Dartmouth in the last 2 years has tried out a prohibition on Greek life for all freshman students during their first 6 weeks on campus, he said. And what we've seen during the period is a great deal in the way of furtive drinking behavior with hard alcohol in dorms, which is, in my opinion, far more dangerous than anything you would see in a Greek basement. There, you at least have some control over liability as a brother who's looking after the well-being of guests to avoid issues with the administration. But also, just having a bunch of inexperienced drinkers around a bottle of vodka in a dorm strikes me as a terrible idea. Unquote. On that, at least, we all agree. My brother graduated from Lehigh 4 years before me. He was president of the class of 1980, and he too wrote the Weekender column for the Brown and White, but did a much better job. For him, it was like covering a beat. We were both brothers at Zeta Psi. I was the House academic chairman. He was the House social chairman. My job was to file all the tests and quizzes in the House library for future reference by the brothers. His was to plan parties and come up with themes, like the one where the guys all wore X-ray vision goggles. Anyway, he doesn't think my Sunday Inquirer column's opening paragraph listing a weekend's worth of Lehigh parties in the early 1980s does justice to the social scene that he remembers from the late 1970s. Some of what he recalls is mind-boggling when viewed through the lens of 2017. For example, today, Greek Week means volleyball and dodgeball competition and or a lip-sync dance contest, but in my brother's era, it meant the campus crawl, an incredible test of endurance where the contestants would walk up and down Lehigh's steep hillside and stop at each of 24 fraternities to chug a beer. Recalls my brother, quote, the perennial winner was a wrestler who could run and puke in stride. It was a thing of beauty, unquote. There was also nude hoops at the Beta House, an annual chugging contest, a beach party at Delta Upsilon facilitated by three or four dump trucks of sand around an above-ground pool into which a volunteer would dive after being doused with lighter fuel and ignited, a wet T-shirt contest at Delta Tau Delta, and Fiji Island, where the brothers would flood their basement and toss in goldfish for effect. I recently read an archived 1985 story in the Allentown Morning Call regarding changes in the Lehigh social scene in which Lehigh's Dean of Students, William Quay, was quoted. Quay suggested that the permissive era at Lehigh in the 1970s was a reaction to students getting interested in the Vietnam War and other world affairs and successfully arguing to the faculty that they were mature and could take responsibility for their own actions. As Quay explained it, the administration bought that line of reasoning. Quote, it's like a seesaw, unquote, Quay said, noting that an incident will occur that causes the administration to become more restrictive, and then 4 years later, a new generation of students will ask why they should be punished for something they did not do, and the restrictions will be lifted. If he was right, maybe the cycle will repeat itself. My Dinner with Roger Stone, Philadelphia Inquirer, August 23rd, 2015. Quote, oh, I went to an orgy there once, unquote. That was Roger Stone's response after I answered his question on my New York City hotel of choice. He's standing shirtless and wearing khakis inside his pied-à-terre on the Upper East Side where we meet before going for a drink and dinner. The two-bedroom with hardwood floors is decorated with vintage martini shakers and political memorabilia, including a poster of Richard Nixon sporting an afro. Stone has just awoken from a well-earned nap. He's had a busy week. After 3 decades of advising Donald Trump, the two have just parted company, and Stone has been busy fielding media inquiries. Whether he quit or was fired depends on which of the two men you ask. Stone pulls a polo shirt, skull and crossbones, no alligator or man on a horse for him, over his bare back, which famously sports a tattoo of Nixon. But before we leave, he asks if I want to see the closet. Mine's an easy call, given his appreciation for sartorial splendor. After the death of Mr. Blackwell in 2008, Stone began publishing his own best and worst dressed list on an annual basis at his website, stonezone.com. Full disclosure, I made the former in 2014. A full wall of his bedroom is filled with neckties, and his closet is packed with seersucker and bespoke suits, although he professes to not having purchased one in years. He tells me the New York Times has a profile of his fashion sensibilities scheduled for its men's style section in September. Quote, my tailor was a Chinese guy on 44th Street named Chen, who was trained on Savile Row, he says. He was skilled and knew to leave enough fabric in the seams for weight fluctuations, unquote. Spending time with this practitioner of political dark arts is a steady diet of stories featuring household names. We begin with a drink at a neighborhood corner spot that Stone says caters to Manhattan Republicans, quote, including Rudy, unquote. When the owner greets him by name, Stone advises to look for a mention of his place in an upcoming tabloid column as the scene of a clandestine political meeting. My hunch is that when it is published, he will be named as one of the attendees. The owner offers a round. Stone demurs. Walking to dinner, Stone tells me we're headed to an Italian restaurant favored by another GOP strategist, Ed Rollins. Quote, "I might stick a fork in his neck if we see him," unquote, he tells me, not laughing.